Welcome to the latest episode of Type 40, a Doctor Who podcast here on the Fandom Podcast Network. On this show, we will take an in-depth and closer look at this beloved television series, the spin-offs, the merchandising, and the global phenomenon that has shaped the landscape of science fiction for over five decades and counting. So step into our TARDIS and please enjoy our journey together here on the Type 40. Now, of course, I'm Kyle, but I can't fly the TARDIS alone, which means I got to bring in my regular co-host to help me control things because the TARDIS can get a little temperamental at times. Please welcome Mr. Dan Hadley back to the Type 40.
Hello, Kyle. I didn't overshoot this time. Correct time zone, correct place.
Yeah, so far, so good. It's going to be an interesting episode of Time 40. It's feeling a little witchy around here, I should say.
Yeah, the witching hour is at hand. I nearly went Vincent Price there. Yeah, it's the spooky side to Doctor Who. This is something we've been a long time coming lately. I'm looking forward to talking about Doctor Who anyway. It's been a few weeks, so yeah, let's get cracking. It's episode 8 as well. Where's the time gone, Kyle?
I know, it's flying by. But too, we've got a little something extra for you on this episode. Not only are Dan and I going to be talking about the Witching Hour, Dan, we got a very special interview that's going to be at the end of this episode.
Oh, yeah? We certainly have. It's a guy called Neil Cole. Neil is, I suppose, he's a sort of entrepreneur, businessman, and a geeky archaeologist, really, of all sorts of props and costumes used in all manner of science fiction movies and TV shows, and a big part of that is classic Doctor Who. So yeah, his exhibit opened not that long ago, and I thought it'd be nice to spend a little time talking to him about all that and a little bit of insight about that side to Doctor Who. So yeah, it's Netflix have already spoken to him. Next it was us. So yeah, look for that later.
That darn Netflix always jumping us on the gun, but we'll take care of that.
I know. Second's not too bad.
Yeah. Well, before we get any further, let's take care of a little business about where you can find Type 40. And not only can you find Type 40 on the FPNet master feed, which is at fpnet.podbean.com. If you're using your mobile device, your Sonic, whatever, download the Podbean app and search Fandom Podcast Network and you can find Type 40. You can also find the Fandom Podcast Network and Type 40 and all the great shows on the Fandom Podcast Network on iTunes, Stitcher. If you have a Google device, you can find us on Google Play, and now we can also be found on Spotify. You can also follow us on Instagram at either the Fandom Podcast Network, or if you want to specifically follow Type 40, you can follow us at Type 40 Doctor Who, TYPE40DRWHO. Dan contributes, our good friend Sarah Graham contributes, everybody contributes around to Type 40. Of course, visit our Facebook page and group as well, a Type 40, a Doctor Who fandom. And you can also email us at type40doctorwho@gmail.com. And you can also follow us on Twitter at type40doctorwho. And again, that's TYPE40DRWHO. If you want to follow me on Twitter, you can follow me at AKyleW. I'm also on Instagram at AKyleFandom. Dan, people can find you all kinds of places on social media. I know this.
Yeah, off by heart now. Dan Hadley _ on Instagram. Sharing mainly geeky pictures and the odd picture from everyday life, in real life as they term it. When I absolutely have to. Most of it's geeky content. Other than that, I'm all over Facebook. In the Spacebook, my social media group for all manner of film and TV shows, and there's a Type 40 Doctor Who Facebook group where we're all still talking about not just Series 11, but anything that springs to mind, mainly what we'd like for Christmas, what Doctor Who things we'd like for Christmas. What's on your Christmas list, Kyle? Anything yet?
Well, it's good that you bring that up, because I know what should be on people's Christmas list, and that is visiting the Fandom Podcast Network store on tpublic.com, where we have all kinds of great gear, including shirts, mugs, pillows, and everything with the Type 40 Doctor Who logo on it. We'd love for you to wear the colors. And if you send us a picture wearing the colors, we'll give you a shout out on the show. Also, we'd love to hear from you and let us know how we're doing. So leave us reviews on iTunes. Just find Fandom Podcast Network, drop us a review. Kevin Reitzel requires only 5-star reviews. I'm a little bit more lenient on that. But, you know, well, we love to hear from our fans and listeners and let us know how we're doing and what we can do to maybe make the show more enjoyable, or something we haven't talked about that you would like to hear us talk about. But, Dan, we've also got a lot of Doctor Who news going on right now. We've got, of course, got the current season running, but we kind of got a little bit I was surprised with the announcement of what the next Blu-ray is. I don't think people were expecting this to necessarily be the next Blu-ray, were they?
not at all. Because, as always with Doctor Who, the speculation always starts months before anything ever gets confirmed. And it's no different with the Blu-rays. We thought that it was going to be a Jon Pertwee set next. In fact, someone not a million miles away was very keen to see that. Norman CLO, that's you. But yeah, it turns out it's going to be another Tom Baker set at the end of February, that's February the 25th, in the Doctor Who, what they badge as Doctor Who The Collection. The next set is going to be season 18, which rather confusingly is Tom Baker's last season. We had his first season in the summer, now we're getting his last season. You've got to fill in the gaps. So nobody really saw that one coming, particularly as it... Just prior to that, in the latter weeks of 2018, the last release had been the season directly after season 19. So they do seem to be making it up as they go along, making the whole range up as they go along. But, Kyle, the list of extras on this, they never let us down.
They're bringing it full force, aren't they, Dan?
Bringing it full force from all quarters. It's not just what they're doing to the material again with it all remastered in high definition where they can, and there's a lot of film inserts in season 18 again, particularly that beautiful tracking shot across the beach in the Leisure Hive. But yeah, it's all being brought up to spec, beautiful HD, and the list of extras includes all the usual making of documentaries, all those little things that were missing from the DVD range. Sorry, they've brought everything up to spec, and lots of exclusive announcements to come too. I would imagine Matthew Sweet's done another long form interview, and those behind the sofa extras where they, if you remember, they get cast members, not always from this era of Doctor Who, they sit them down on a sofa, Gogglebox style, and play them old clips, which they sometimes have a good giggle about. Giggle at Doctor Who? I don't know. They have a good giggle about, or they can sometimes get quite emotional about, or other times they just thrill to. So those things, I think we all like a little bit of that. There's something voyeuristic about that, Kyle. I think when it comes to our geeky entertainment, we can never get enough layers underneath that which we enjoy. So yeah, season 19 is already on my Christmas list, and I'll certainly be pre-ordering series 18 too. Whether season 10 is coming or not, I don't know. It had been listed at a retailer in Australia. They put it out. So you would say, there's no smoke without fire. I keep saying that. So season 10 might be coming a little later with the Three Doctors and whatnot. But in the meantime, more Tom Baker. That's never a bad thing.
Nope, absolutely. Get your jelly babies ready. But that's not the only classic Who thing we've got coming up. Because, you know, one of the things with Doctor Who is a lot of newer fans that have been jumping on. A lot of the old Who footage has been lost over the years, whether due to fire or just pieces missing. And I think they finally found a way to get that old footage out, Dan, but in a new style, because they're bringing the Mokra Terror, which will come out on March 18th, as another fully animated second Doctor Who story from 1967. Tell us a little bit about this, because you're a little more familiar with this than I am, being classic Who.
Yeah, some listeners may already be aware of this. This is the second, well, third really, but so I call it the second of these productions where they've gone back to the Troughton era, which so much of it still doesn't exist, and take those episodes that don't exist in picture form and remake them as full animations. They take the fully animated new versions, match them to the original soundtrack, which still exists and is always cleaned up and into sort of HD standard, you could say, and basically roll them out as a new presentation, giving new life to the old material and make sure that those missing stories don't stay lost stories. This is the second one, The Power of the Daleks, which was Troughton's very first story, was out in 2016. And this looks like the same animation team bringing the Mokra Terror to life. The Mokra Terror is a four-part story from 67. So it's not quite as long, but it's got some fan-favourite monsters in there. Fan-favourites, they only appeared once, but since they appeared later, sort of appeared anyway, in Gridlock in a sort of cameo role. The Macra have taken on a bit of a new life. So I think a lot of people are going to be very happy to see a good old-fashioned monster yarn done in this particular way. And it gets premiered at the BFI. You know, they roll out this stuff. They treat it in a very sort of prestigious way. So it's out on DVD. It'll be out on Blu-ray. There'll also be a colour version for people who prefer not to watch the black and white. And there's the option to buy a steel book of it too for the real collectors out there. So several buying options. I would imagine it'd be available to stream as well, Kyle. You're a streamer, aren't you?
Yeah. Though they haven't put out the. It's kind of interesting because you have a lot of the classic stuff out for streaming, but I don't know if they've put out these remastered sets yet. So it's kind of interesting to see how they're going to attack it. But you know what? We have even more Doctor Who releases because we're talking about the current season of Doctor Who getting released on January 29th, 2019 in both a regular format and a steelbook option. But on top of that, too, also beginning of January, we have the album soundtrack coming out for season 11.
So excited about that. I don't know about you. For me, Seiga Nakanoa has been the star of Series 11. I think his work's been consistently brilliant and evocative and complementary to the material. In fact, it's the way that all good music in a TV show should be. It's lifted, supported the material. And I can't wait to hear this stuff. I mean, the few little bits that they've put out, you know, they've previewed bits of it through social media, haven't they? The way they like to get you to part with your money. I was going to buy this anyway. I think it's fantastic. Just to get his version of the theme tune, which is perhaps my favourite, Kyle. I don't know about you. It's maybe my favourite of the new ones.
It's up there. It's up there for me, for sure.
It was fantastic stuff. And yeah, I believe, I mean, you can get this stuff on Spotify as well, but there's nothing like owning something like this in a deluxe digipack presentation with the art cards and various other things that they come with. I think Doctor Who collectors, they really jump on this sort of stuff. And, you know, I must admit, I miss Murray Gold sometimes, but everything has its time, and Seiga Nakanoa is very much the way forward. I can't wait to. I hope he stays with the show. Can't wait to hear what he does next.
Yeah, it's outstanding. I'll definitely get in that. I think the pre-release is January 11th or something like that, and you can pre-order it on iTunes right now as well. So
yeah, they've been very quick. They've been very quick with all this. You talk about the DVD of Series 11. I mean, sometimes it's been several months before press. First tongue tie of this episode. Sometimes it's been several months before they've got those Blu-rays out. They're right to get on this really, really quickly. And I mean, obviously it's too late for people's Christmas stockings, but it'll be enough to keep the series in people's conscience over the next few months.
Yeah. Well, since we're talking about the series and keeping it in people's conscience, let's talk about episode 8 of this current season of Doctor Who, The Witchfinders. We got
some interesting things to talk about with this one.
Following trips to civil rights era America and India at the time of the partition earlier in the series, we're again shooting down the time vortex with the Doctor and friends for episode 8. The Witchfinders begins with them leaving the TARDIS and immediately into the throes of a full-on witch hunt among the community of a small Lancashire town, a town 21st century history has seemingly forgotten. Dan, I gotta be honest with you. I've never been a big fan of the witch trial episodes and shows because they always just feel a little repetitive to me. So I was curious to see the Doctor's take on this. What were your first reactions to the episode?
Well, as somebody who was told and learnt a little about this era, certainly in British history, about witch trials, you know, I've wanted Doctor Who to handle this for a while, if I'm honest. And there's something about it when the whole process and how militant they were about it. When you hear about it now, it really brings a lump to the throat. It's almost unbelievably cruel and unfair and indiscriminate. Where, you know, so I don't think that ever loses its power. But I do know exactly what you mean. I think it probably is a well-trod road. I believe that programs like Supernatural have done quite a lot with this sort of material. Now, I don't watch Supernatural, but I think it's a big part of it. And there's been a Doctor Who novel set during the Salem witch trials, which is a huge part of American historical culture, isn't it? You know, it's something you're quite you're quite aware of, and you do see it a lot in movies. So, yeah, I probably don't quite share your fatigue for it. But, I mean, did it not throw a new angle on it? For you, though, Kyle, it being in Britain, I mean, a witch trial is a witch trial, isn't it? But
yeah, no, I mean, it definitely throws a new angle on it, and especially when you have a script by Joy Wilkinson. And this is one of the very few Doctor Who stories to circle the subject of witchcraft. You know, there were things I liked about the story, but for me, I'm going to be honest with you, this kind of felt like one of those episodes that was just there. It was like, it didn't feel like it accomplished anything. It was a very self-contained story, which I'm fine with that aspect of it. It was just, I don't know, it seemed to be missing something, but I will say this about this episode, that's something that was made this a much watch for me, and that was the guest cast in this episode.
Oh, yes. Anybody in particular?
Well, for me, it was one Mr. Alan Cumming, of course, playing King James I. But I mean, Dan, I'm going to ask you to pronounce your name because I know I will get it wrong.
Oh, you're Siobhan Finneman, who played, she was Becca, who I suppose you could say she was the villain in the end. She turned out to be the villain. She's a very well-known actress in this country, TV and movies, it's been stretching back 30, 40 years. Somebody who can play comedy and drama, both really, really well. So I was ecstatic to see that she was appearing in Doctor Who this year. And that didn't disappoint. She was excellent. The part was perfect for her. And the twists and turns of the character, I thought she fit that like a glove, really. She responded to it all really well. Because, you know, when you see people have... Well, any actors, I suppose, but anybody who's got this sort of profile and calibre, as both Finneman and Cumming have got, you do wonder. We know they have a laugh in between shooting scenes of this show, and they, you know, it's the silliness of it all, I'm sure, isn't lost on them. But to keep a straight face with all that prosthetics and all this sort of thing, but she does get to go the whole range. I think her character, I think Becca, has a real arc, as King James does too, and the way they go parallel to one another, there's something about that which where the rest of the episode slips into being perhaps a little humdrum and maybe you could accuse it of being filler. I think those two characters are really what keeps your interest as a viewer going along. I thought it was generally pretty well put together and decently written. There's been a lot of first time writers this series, and some of them have more credits than others, you know, even on other things. A lot of them come, at least two of them are playwrights, which I'm all for bringing people like that through, particularly if they know and they love Doctor Who and there's a story that they really, really want to tell. And Joy Wilkinson, and I've never seen any of her other work, but I get the impression that this was very much a labour of love, and that this particular period in history was something she really wanted to visit and explore. So yeah, it's another chunk of historical fiction. Yes, the BBC does do this stuff really, really well. The costume drama. So you could accuse it of being low hanging fruit in a sense. And yeah, I mean, I've had a big problem with some of the politics in this series, as I'm sure anybody who's listened to more than one episode of the podcast will know. And that was still present. It was very much still present. But when it comes down to the blueprint of it, was a standard Monster of the Week story and some fairly traditional thrills. And I think when you've had a season so far which has been so untraditional, this is probably quite welcome. And if we've got a bad guy, not just Becca, but the creatures, the Morax creatures that we'll talk about in a little while, they're elements that children can imitate in the playground. That's never a bad thing. Whether they'd imitate King James I, I'm not sure, because that is a really big performance and probably the standout performance of the season, let alone the episode, Kyle.
Okay, well, let me ask you about that, because the great Alan Cumming played King James I, and it's the first time I can remember in a while where somebody played King James I with some possible historical referencing that doesn't get recognized a lot, Dan.
Yeah.
And I want you to speak on that because you know a little bit more about that than I do.
Yeah, I'm not a history buff. I I'm very wary of coming on this show and making out like I am, because there are real history buffs listening to this show, I've no doubt, and they'll be able to tell that I'm not. But yeah, he was the son of Mary Queen of Scots, and he was king at the time of the Gunpowder Plot, and you know, so that's where I know King James I from. But I'd heard when it became obvious, because Alan Cumming dropped out during the rounds of interviews building up to this. He dropped it out months ago that he was going to be in Doctor Who playing this part. And immediately people started talking about this, because Alan Cumming himself is bisexual and a very high-profile actor. And King James I is, you know, he's believed by scholars, by the scholars out there, it's believed that King James I was also bisexual. And he's married, he's got children and whatnot. But yeah, it's believed that some of his partners were male. And so how much would that be brought into Doctor Who? And I thought it was brought just like the character from top to bottom was brought really, really well. It was really well realised and really nicely written. I thought the dialogue was great, which meant that for Alan Cumming to deliver this huge performance, it wasn't all too much, because what he was saying was really quite well crafted and impossible not to respond to, really. I thought he was a very sympathetic character and a multi-layered character, and the scenes that he shared, particularly with the Doctor, were some of the best of the episode. So for me, it'll always be the one with Alan Cumming. He's a huge Doctor Who fan, and he was offered the role of the Doctor, Kyle, believe it or not, years ago.
Yeah, I have heard that. You know, you got to bring up his scenes with Tos and Ryan as well.
Yeah, well, yeah, I mean, even that, you know, that it was delightful. I mean, at the end of the day, this was a married man. You know, he was a married man who was playing away. But what I liked was the way that Ryan responded to it. I thought the lightness of touch. Tosin Cole, I don't think he's been served particularly well by the last few episodes. I think, and the character in the first 2 weeks I thought was immensely likable, and he seemed to be quite a physical actor and hasn't had a great deal to do ever since. But at times he looked bored even. But in this one, he was, it was as much in the body language and what he chose not to say as what he did say, and the way he responded to King James. Interest in it, you know, it was just all really, it was very 21st century, I suppose. But it was just played really, really well. It wasn't Sledgehammer. It wasn't Sledgehammer style. And that stands out in this season of Doctor Who, because we've had quite a lot. We've been beaten over the head with quite a lot of issues and things. And gay life isn't an issue. You know, it's a fact of life. And so to see it handled in this way, I thought that was really nicely done. So you know,
yeah. And I would be remiss if I didn't think this was one of Jodie's best episodes as the Doctor, because it felt like the most well balanced episode. We saw the return of the psychic paper yet again. And the fact that they're starting to give her more tools to work with besides the sonic screwdriver. And it just, she felt to me in this episode, she acted how the Doctor would act in this situation.
In general, I agree. I mean, my major problem with the 13th Doctor so far is that we've seen four or five different versions of her. And sometimes within the same episode, but in this episode, she was consistent and she did push that through. And the one of the things that I like about what Jodie does do, I think she's got a great physicality to her. And in this, we saw, I mean, they did some terrible things to her, didn't they? You know, she got ducked. She got very, very wet and dirty and breathless. And it looked freezing cold and very uncomfortable just on dry land wherever they shot this, you know, let alone where she gets out soaking wet. I would imagine there was a very big puffy coat waiting sort of off camera to be wrapped around our lead actress, you know, when the camera's cut. But yeah, all that stuff was really, really good. And at the end of the day, this story was, it wasn't contrived, but it was incredibly predictable. Story beats. You, when you hear that Doctor Who is going to go to the, to any kind of witch trial, you know pretty much what to expect. I even expected the name drop of Houdini. I knew exactly how she was going to get out of that. And so to hold, and children will feel differently, of course they will. They might not have seen any of this before, but to hold my attention during all this, you know, you've got to be, you've got to bring some sort of truth and be consistent. And this was more consistent than a great many episodes so far this year, despite the predictability. I still think elements of the performance are a bit clumsy, but it's far from the worst we've seen so far. Yaz felt a little bit unloved again this week, wouldn't you say, Kyle?
Yeah, and I think what we're seeing out of that is just the fact that three people on the TARDIS with the Doctor is too many. I just don't think they have enough time to give everybody something to do.
And it's such a pity. I mean, you had a brilliant idea a couple of episodes back about how they could have brought them in and out and kind of rotated the cast as they reconnect with contemporary Earth, which I think was a great idea. But to have them all sort of just trailing along with not necessarily anything to do, it's a shame. It's a great shame and a little bit of indignity to actors who we know they're good. We know they're a decent fit for the part and we know they're good because we've seen them be good in previous episodes. Mandip Gill was terrific in the opening episode, and we've seen flashes of that as the weeks have gone on, but just not enough, and not with enough consistency. I think she's come off the worst of the three so far.
Yeah, no, I would agree with that. But let's talk too about the monster in this episode, the Morax. Of course, this episode was directed by Sally Apperman, she also directed Arachnids in the UK, which is probably the only, really, the second truly monster episode of the season. Well, how did you feel about the Morax? Because they kind of felt, they didn't feel fresh. They didn't feel like there was anything really to them.
No. you could say witches are witches. And, you know, we get them every Halloween on chocolate boxes, and we see them in all manner of films from, you know, we see Bette Midler dressed up as a witch for whatever that film was in the late 80s. All these things, Roald Dahl books. So witches have been done to death too. But within Doctor Who, there's been very little witchcraft. But the one that sticks in the mind the most are the Carrionites from Series 3. With the Shakespeare Code episode, and I do think this episode does steal a little from that one, but without that spark, or without the charm of that episode and the real feeling that it was worked into the plot completely, that it really belonged there. So I do think that over time, as good as Siobhan Finneman was as the lead Morax when she took her place among them, I do feel that they'll likely get a little bit forgotten.
I think so too.
The makeup wasn't particularly good either, was it? I mean, there's a certain, obviously, because we saw some, whereas the Carrionites were actual sort of full facial makeups, weren't they? I'm doing this with my hand across. You can't see this, Kyle can. They were full makeups, full cast. This was much more subtle, apart from with Becca, funnily enough. And I think that was supposed to bring a bit more horror to it, particularly in the case of the grandmother character. But I don't know. It just looked a little bit cheap. I'm not entirely sure. And considering that the locations were so good, you know, wherever it was, like I say, I mean, even the interiors, whichever building they filmed that in, wherever that was, that looked freezing cold in there. It looked like an ice box. So it just looked a little bit unloved, I think.
I think that's a fair assessment. You know, I would put this kind of in the middle of the pack for this season. It wasn't a bad episode, but it felt like it was missing just a little something with it.
They didn't bring in the fantasy, the bigger fantasy aspects of the story early enough, I felt, because it wasn't horrific enough, and it just wasn't plain scary enough. That's the big problem. It had no real atmosphere and not much element of danger. And I think if it had had a bit more, if it had looked a bit bleached out the way that the film Sleepy Hollow did, and a lot of Tim Burton stuff, if it had had that look to it, it would have had much more threat to the whole piece. So when they do bring the fantastical elements, which were that was sound enough, the idea of the tree acting as the lock on this sort of containment of witches, it's a nice idea, but it comes into play so late. And when the Doctor gets to the sort of meat of the problem and solves it the way that we like the Doctor to, again, it's constant exposition all the time, with the Doctor talking at people and restating just to make sure that we got it. And maybe Joy Wilkinson's inexperience shows itself a little bit there. Maybe it's with the script editor. I don't know. It's just, it all adds to, as you say, this episode feeling like... It does stand out in Series 11, but if this were in any other era, it would be another Night Terrors. It would be another 42. It would be forgotten pretty quick.
Yeah. Well, we're going to have a little break here and let everybody know what else is going on around the Phantom Podcast Network. And when we come back, we have a very special interview for you.
Thank you for listening. We hope you're enjoying this podcast. We'd like to recommend these other great podcasts on the Fandom Podcast Network. It starts with our flagship show, Culture Clash, our weekly pop culture podcast with the latest news, reviews, and other fun topics in pop culture. Also, Blood of Kings, a Highlander podcast where we discuss all things Highlander. Couch Potato Theater, our podcast celebrating the cult classic and fan favorite movies we don't get off the couch for. Time Warp, a look back on our classic and nostalgic fandoms that we still celebrate today. The End Zone, our podcast talking about all things current in the NFL and giving our best mediocre fantasy football advice. Good Evening, an Alfred Hitchcock podcast. Discoville, a Star Trek Discovery and the Orville podcast. The Hair Metal Podcast, if you're a hard rock music fan, the Hair Metal Podcast rediscovers the nostalgia of the 1980s hair metal bands. And Type 40, a Doctor Who podcast, as we discuss all things Doctor Who, past and present. You can find these great shows on the Fandom Podcast Master Feed at fpnet.podbean.com. The Fandom Podcast Network is on iTunes, Stitcher, Podbean, Google Play. On Facebook, you can find us at Fandom Podcast Network. On Instagram, we are at Fandom Podcast Network. And on Twitter, at FanPod Network. You can also email us directly at fandompodcastnetwork@gmail.com. Thank you so much for listening and support the Fandom Podcast Network. And remember, respect others and enjoy your fandom.
So, Dan, at the top of the show, we talked about this a little bit. We have a very special interview with one Neil Cole, who has got himself quite an interesting collection of science fiction, especially classic Doctor Who.
He certainly has. I can't remember exactly how many he's got, but yeah, I was impressed. I think you probably will be too when you hear the interview with him.
Yeah, and Neil has a science fiction television museum that he just opened just a few months ago. There's actually a spot on Netflix, which he's going to talk about, which talks about this museum, as well as he has a YouTube channel and a page on Facebook, which we will provide links for you here. But this is a very fascinating interview, especially for you classic Who fans. So without further ado, here's Dan sitting down with Neil Cole. Well, we got a very special section here for you on this episode of Type 40. Dan, you have brought us a very special guest to talk some Doctor Who.
Yeah, well, because it's the Fandom Podcast Network, one of the things we like to do is get some voices in from across fandom to talk about, you know, their particular connection with Doctor Who, where it comes from, and how they take it through, sort of, if they were a child when they first found it, sort of into adult life, and how that gets sort of put on a larger scale. And, this guest sort of illustrates that. I can't think of anybody who could illustrate it more. He's the curator of the UK's newest, very geeky place to sort of to check into. And it's the Museum of Classic Science Fiction. His name's Neil Cole. Thank you for joining us, Neil. How are you?
Oh, I'm well, thanks. I'm just saying it's a snowstorm up here, literally, in the last half hour. So I've fled, boxed up the Dalek outside, poor thing, and fled upstairs to talk to this. This is much nicer up here, to be honest, at the minute.
So what does it more resemble at the moment? Is it like the ice planet of Hoth, or is it the surface of the Antarctic with the where the Cybermen do all their stalking? Is it a bit like any of those things?
it feels a bit like I was in the museum. It was like Kurt Russell and The Thing. You know, there was sort of weird noises outside. I was like, some sort of multi-headed dog thing to slop its way in or something. You know, I'm glad to be upstairs.
So, well, tell us about your museum. If there are people out there listening who think, oh, you know, I'd love to visit somewhere like that. Where are you? How long have you been open? And how's it all going?
Okay, I've been open since October. I'm open 4 days a week, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, Monday. And we're in Northumberland, in the North Pennines, which is an area of outstanding natural beauty. So it's a beautiful neck of the woods. A lot of people haven't been. It's really worth coming from. We're not far from the Roman Wall. There's a lovely little observatory that's been set up as well, not far from us here. And basically, how's it going? We had our 600th visitor since October last weekend. And even though it's snowing outside, I had a few people have traveled. I had someone who traveled from Snowdonia today. Two people, a sci-fi author, actually, who's just starting off, had traveled from Snowdonia in Wales. I mean, you could have knocked me over because I'm just painting some bits and dusting, you know, not expecting to see a soul today. You know? just more worried about, you know, how hot my coffee is. And then suddenly there's a guy at the door and he's from Snowdonia. You know, amazing. And it's that, but it's Doctor Who, isn't it? It's science fiction. And we do this sort of thing. I do this sort of thing. I used to travel all over the country to find anything. If somebody said there was a Doctor Who costume on display, I was like a whippet. I would be there.
Even if it was just the one?
Oh, I traveled to Cornwall to see a Zygon once. That's now Cornwall. That's like, you know, that's a good 500 miles from here.
Yeah, because you're just outside. It's just outside Newcastle, isn't it? That whole area. So yeah. I'm in Birmingham. So I'd have to. Yeah, it's serious traveling down there.
No, that's nothing. Birmingham. You've got a little sci-fi museum in Brumyard called not far from you, which I travel down to. It's a little bit like what I do. It's not quite the same. In a place called Brumyard, and I travelled down about 2 years ago. I've done it a few times. I just look at it as a day out to see interesting things, you know. I just love it. I love people's passions. That's what's nice. I've been to lots of corporate exhibitions, you know, the BBC ones, but they're great. I mean, they've got access, obviously, to everything, but there's something lovely about when people put their heart and soul. It's not a corporation doing this. This is the individual's love of something. That's what is really lovely.
And how did you got started through Kickstarter? Am I right?
No. Kickstarter helped finish me off, in the nicest possible way. Without Kickstarter, I wouldn't be open now. I'd be open in another 2 years, I would say. It was my wife suggested Kickstarter, and I've never asked anybody for any money in my life. You know, I've always grafted away to get whatever, sold things, you know, whatever to do to get the collection together. But to get the building I'm in is a grade two listed building. So you're coming to a 300-year-old cellar if you visit. And I've literally done all the stonework by hand. I had to repair the ceiling, put a new ceiling in, a new floor in. That's why it's taken 4 years. And the last year, we have Netflix came and filmed. And along with Netflix, I did the Kickstarter, which I didn't know how I was going to go. And I got about £10,000 from Kickstarter donors, which was amazing. Now, that £10,000, it paid for the materials, really. It wasn't as much work. It was just simply wood and the raw materials, the glass. Each sheet of glass cost me £120 because it's got to be safety glass. And you put that through the whole museum and this starts to mount up pretty quick. So it was Kickstarter literally got me finished to this point now.
It's kind of a case of just like the film, the quote from the movie, if you build it, they will come. And so you had the collection. So the collection predates your museum by quite a long way. And how about you specifically in Doctor Who? Did all this start for you with Doctor Who? And did you find Doctor Who or did it find you? How old were you?
Oh, I mean, I my earliest memories of Doctor Who. I'm old now. So, you know, I'm like nearly 50. So I was growing up. You dive off your bike, you know, put down whatever you were doing and you dash in to watch a 20-minute fix of Doctor Who on a Saturday night. And there was nothing else on for the young'uns out there. There was so little. There was Star Trek, the original series. Now, I mean, I love, that was on BBC One, but I love Monsters. And Star Trek, the original series is I hate to say it, guys, it's desperately short of monsters. Doctor Who was not the same. Doctor Who was monster world, you know? You had some of the great, and especially in the mid-70s, you had John Friedlander, his superpowers, knocking out crinoids, Zygons, Morbius. You know, what a time to watch Doctor Who when you were five. I mean, it was amazing. And then the killer moment was my dad once took me down to, on a drinking weekend, not for me, for him. We went down to Blackpool, and the Doctor Who exhibition was there, about 1976. And there was no merchandise then. This is the other thing, zero. There was the Target books. I got my first Target book that year, which was the Zabi. And I hadn't a bloody clue who the guy was on the front cover, you know, whoever he was. And then you went to the Doctor Who music, the exhibition, and there was the Wirren, there was Steyr, who's my favourite all-timer. There was the Dark. It was just, it was mind-blowing. And I remember then, just I remember all I got at the end of that museum was a helium balloon with a Dalek on it. And the disappointment of coming out with a helium balloon with a Dalek on it, and then spending the next 2 days trying to work out how many ways to entertain myself with a helium balloon. I just thought, I want to do this. You know, I want this. I never thought I ever would.
But you want to be a model maker or a costume maker or an effects man? Is that where your ambitions lay originally?
Yeah, oh yeah, I want to make monsters. I mean, I either want to be a comic artist or make monsters. I still think I might end up writing a comic or two before a car kit. It's on my bucket list. But I think I'm quite happy. You know, if I carved it tomorrow, I could actually say, you know, you could put on my tombstone, he did make a Doctor Who museum. He did it. He was 50 and he did it. I'm not quite 50, but you know what I mean.
Yeah.
It is quite an achievement, really. Because I have done it mostly myself. And the lucky bit, right, was the collection's taken time. The lucky bit, the break we got was getting the building. But when I say it was like, I'm watching The Haunting of Hill House at the minute. And this makes Hill House, our house, it made Hill House look like a luxury apartment. You know, it was pretty awful, the house, when we got it. We got it very reasonably. And that was the stroke of luck, you know?
It seems like a very fitting place to gather together all these things, like it's part of the atmosphere, somewhere with character, somewhere that's, you know, not far from impossible to get to, but a little bit off the beaten track as well. That's part of the... There's a certain romance about that lends itself very well to geeky interests, aren't there?
Yeah, I don't know if you ever went to Llangollen when it was open, the Doctor Who experience at Llangollen. Yeah.
Three or four
and
times.
I was never in fandom particularly. You know, I was a fan, but like one of these isolated fans who just sort of read and, you know, watched more films than I should do. And then one day I just realised Llangollen was open. I didn't realize these props still existed. I knew a lot had been auctioned off in the 90s. I had no idea, like the original Axon costume, the surviving Axon was there. Morbius, I had no idea. And I drove down to Llangollen. I got my car license late because I came from zero money. This is the funny thing. People say, oh, you must be really wealthy. No, I had a very, you know, I had about five Target books and a knackered Dennis Fisher, Tom Baker, you know? Was not wealthy. And it was just sheer bloody-mindedness, really, that I managed this. And anyway, I finally got a really small little car, and I drove to Llangollen, and it blew my mind, Llangollen. And it was just not... The place itself was wonderful, you know? I love the idea you got an all-day ticket. I love the place. It was a nice place to visit. And
you could go around the toy factory as well, and you could actually go around the place where they made these...
Yeah.
That was about Would you say that was half of the exhibit? For the people who are listening who haven't been, half of the exhibit was the toy factory, wasn't it? Where they had the license to make the official thing at the time. And the other half was an exhibition.
Yeah, I mean, when I went there, the toy thing was shut. You could walk around it. But again, it's worth remembering, I guess, that we're surrounded, aren't we, by merchandise of massively good quality. The quality of figures now. I mean, that's another thing. I've done the odd figure sculpt. I love, you know... Good quality stuff. Dapol was, how do we say it? I mean, I'm very fond of Dapol figures. But we would be lying here, wouldn't we, if we sat here and said they were accurate. I mean, I'm really not going to say anything else because I love them. You know,
they are a parallel universe of Doctor Who. It's all very quaint and it's all done you can see it was done with as much care as they could, dependent yes. on the budget, the logistics they'd got to work with at the time, yeah. and to be yeah. fair, the profile of the series at the time too. So it's very yeah. it's very hard to be too cruel to that. Yeah. And they did endure, yeah. and people still talk about them.
The thing with what's interesting about Daypaw is that around the same time, you had McFarlane came out, remember, with the Spawn action figures, and you had these incredibly detailed figures came out, and then you'd still be buying Daypaw figures, which was the contrast was insane, really, wasn't it? You had sort of like the Movie Maniac series.
Very much so.
They were just high quality, but Daypaw, it was the only Doctor Who. The other thing was Harlequin miniatures. I love those, the little metal miniatures.
Those were the ones you had to paint those yourself, didn't you?
Yeah, I love those. I got a huge collection. Anyway, I'm digressing, but yeah, that was the Llangollen. That experience, it taught me a lot about. Look, I thought, well, if you can have this in Llangollen, if you can do that there, then why not the Northeast? I mean, from us up north, there's, you know, you would hardly get anything. You know what I mean? If somebody in fancy dress rolls around the street as R2-D2, you can imagine the local press turning up. Do you know what I mean? Do you know what I mean?
It's just, yeah, absolutely.
Like, you know, it was the birth of science fiction. So I just thought, right, I'm going to open a science fiction museum. I'm going to do it. You know, and it was
It's still a big leap from having, you know, you've a few, some Target books, some Daypaw figures, and yeah. what we did accumulate as fans, I was there too, you know, through the late 70s or yeah. the 80s, what we'd accumulate where we could, the Doctor Who bubble bath, yeah. that year's yeah. Skeletor calendar, whatever. It's a big yeah. leap from that to opening yeah. a museum. What was your very first prop or costume? Can you remember what it was?
Do you remember Seven's models?
Yes.
The Sevens models kit. Yeah. I remember getting I always wanted a Dalek. I always wanted to make a Dalek. Again, just lack of money and expertise and knowledge how to go around things. I was an artist, you know, I could draw anything, but it was just lack of experience with other materials. And I remember contacting Stuart Evans and getting an original cast of a cyber helmet from him, which I still have. And that was amazing. It needed finishing. It'd be made by production. He'd got it to work with. And, it was just that in itself was just like a wow. And then the biggie
fact,
was
the fact that it was screen used, the fact that it had been on screen.
It was production made. Okay. You know, so it was made by the Beeb, but it was never finished. So it was a bit bashed. It had been chucked around a lot, used by them for various things, you know, and it ultimately was yeah. a reject. That didn't matter to me. To me, it was wow, that is actually from the place that makes Doctor Who. That was good enough for me. You know, that was like. I remember getting it. I remember going up to my friend. We're the same age, and we were both wearing this really dangerous to wear helmet, and you know, getting cuts on our face from fiberglass, and thinking that was marvellous because we were actually wearing a BBC made cyber thing. And then after that, there was the Bonhams auction. Do you remember that? The 1990s one. It was like it was on Blue Peter. I remember, and I just remember feeling I had no money. I just started as a student. And I just had no money, you know, and I just remember wanting to cry. And I thought, do you know, I would probably sell my clothes and my left kidney for a Sand Dweller's scarf. I thought, what's the worst prop in that auction? It's got to be a Sand Dweller's, you know, turban. I thought, I would sell my kidney just to have a little bit of something from that auction, you know. And I just thought that would be the end of it. I thought their props would go, and which they did. I bought the catalogue. Even the catalogue felt like a lot of money then. Got the catalogue, and then I thought that would be the end of it for me. I just thought, I just used to reread that catalogue. Now then slowly, props kept filtering out. I had no idea there were other auctions that had gone on as well. But again, I've never been in the know, so I missed out on a lot of the earlier auctions where things went relatively cheaply, to be honest, now, compared to prices now. And then after that, I then started to buy them. And it would take me like a proper year. I mean, I would have to, once I started teaching, I could then do, you know, monthly payments on something. I mean, I really have done it the most agonizingly slow way imaginable, you know. I still haven't got a Sand Dweller's turban. You know, so if anyone out there is listening to this, I'll have it. I'll pay you good money for it.
How many items do you own now, both in the exhibition or not?
Oh, I mean, I've got two halves of the exhibition. One is Doctor Who Classic. Mm. I have seven, I think it's about 80 props from Doctor Who Classic, which doesn't, I don't know if that sounds like a lot or a little. It's basically that includes 84, things like
85 more
silent.
Than I've got.
Okay. bearing in mind, I sold every bit of merchandise to do this. All my character options figures, which I adore, in past tense, because they're no longer with me. You know, I got £3,000 selling that lot. It's amazing. That went straight into prop. And I don't buy merchandise. I just can't, because I've got no money for it, basically, because I'm buying these bleeding things. But I love it. You know, I do. I love it. And the other thing is, what I do is, because I'm a sculptor, really, I can fix things. So, like, at the minute, actually, sorry, this is what I'm working on at the minute. I don't know if you can see it. This is like a cheetah person head. So this is, I've got the original cheetah person, right? But the mouth, the face...
From the 1989 story Survival.
And basically what you've got here... Oh, God, there's his teeth gone. Sorry. What you've got there is the original head, but the face rotted away. So when I got it, I've got the full costume on display in the museum, but the no head. And I thought, right, okay, I'll sculpt the face and then I'll wrap the fur around again. Now, if I was to go to, say, a prop maker professionally, that would be a couple of £1,000 of work. I can do it for nothing. So that's how, like, the pterolectyl I've got on display, which I think is probably a couple of years of work I put into that. I've re-sculpted all the missing areas because it was in the Longleat fire, the Longleat exhibition fire. And I was able to do that. And that means that we've now got, I've got the original head, the surviving head, which is in, it needed repair. But when I put it back on, it was the green head. Basically, the BBC had shoved the green animatronic leader head on the red body. And when I started putting it all together, I just thought, oh, that's just wrong. You know, I can't do that because I'm a bit sort of OCD. I thought, no, I can't do that. So I've ended up making the top head again. And it looks, I think it was pretty good. And I think so people can come and see a complete pterolectyl now. But, you know, I couldn't afford, when you go to a big auction, you've got some big money in the room, big money in the room. And so you've got to just be stealth. I guess I go for the things that I can rescue. Things that might, and other people just go, other people might throw in the bin. I'll have a damn good go at. And, part of the project is to make these things survive. I mean, it's the only surviving pterolectyl body that I'm aware of now left. The Garm's another one. I've rescued the Garm and repaired him. He'd been abused.
Seems to me that you've had to become, you wear several hats with all this. You're part businessman, you're part Indiana Jones, the Indiana Jones of costumes, restoration expert. Yeah. And obviously, there's the fan side to you as well. When you watch Doctor Who now, when you have got the time, when you watch Doctor Who now, do you watch it still very much with this eye for the monsters, for the costumes, for what may make a good exhibit in the future if you're able to expand and continue?
There's a thrill of seeing something you've repaired in the show. So, for example, what I do, the only thing I watch every week is classic Doctor Who. Okay, I watch classic Doctor Who every with my daughter. I've got two children, and my eldest daughter and I love classic Doctor Who, and she loves John Pertwee. So we watch John Pertwee a lot. So we watch the Sea Devils. We're in the middle of the Sea Devils, and I've got a Sea Devil arm in the museum. And there's only about four surviving original sections of anything from a Sea Devil surviving, right? And I've got one of the arms. You know, to my knowledge, there's two heads. Wow. And two arms, and I've got one of the arms in, you know, and it looks to the general public like a dish rag. Okay, I mean, this is not something most people would want in their home. However, to me, it is a bit of pure magic, you know, and you get people, and so then when I'm watching Doctor Who and you see that scene where they come out the water, you just think, wow, you know, a little bit of history downstairs. That's, I don't know which arm it is, you know, but you know, it's one of those arms is coming in there, you know. And so how do I watch Doctor Who? I can still actually suspend my disbelief in classic Who. I know it's a single set often. I know it's multi-camera. I know all the tech stuff. But there's something about it still catches me. And it's lovely watching it with my daughter.
Does New Who still make you feel the same way? Do you still get that kick out of New Who too? Not to the same extent?
No.
So do you but from no, somebody... But Sorry. From somebody who's interested in costumes and those techniques, does that side to you kick in when you watch that and you wonder, oh, how did they do that? That prosthetic, can you still watch it with those eyes as part of the
fun? Yes. In fact, I would say that's the only way I can watch new Doctor Who is probably, I mean, Doctor Who's never had better production, a chance to shine through production than ever. I mean, clearly, it's insane what they've got now. When you watch something like The Sea Devils, and then you watch new Doctor Who, it's mad. I mean, it's like, it's a divide, isn't it? But what I think, it reminds me that some of the strongest, it says something about the classic run's strength of design, that some of the old episodes stand and fall by literally the strength of the design, because it's not the actual techniques they've got. But the new show, yeah, I mean, basically my favorite aspect of the new show would be the creature design, would be the production values, I guess, you know, that's what that involves. The writing hasn't, and this isn't, again, I don't want to sort of get into is new good, good, bad, whatever. It's about, I guess it's like anything. It's a story that resonates with you or doesn't. And the way the Doctor particularly has been handled for me over the last few years has not resonated with me personally. Basically, in a nutshell, I never wanted him to be a romantic character. I liked him as a paternal character. Mm-hmm. So I never wanted him having relationships, because that to me spoils something of the innocence of that original character. That was something magical about the fact he wasn't that. And I personally, if I'd been in charge of it, would never have gone there. The companions can do whatever they bloody like, you know. it was just, there you go.
And that purity of the tea time monster movie is still where you find the sweet spot with Doctor Who, ideally.
Yeah.
Remind us, Neil, where exactly are you, and where can people come and take a look at what you've got and where you are and the whole story of your museum? Where can they find you on social media, on Facebook, on Twitter?
Yeah.
Are you all across that?
Yeah, I mean, basically where I'm in Northumberland. It's the Museum of Classic Science Fiction. If you go on Facebook and put in Neil Cole's Adventures in Science Fiction, you'll get the Facebook page. The Facebook page is like being my blog. My wife made me do it a few years ago, and it's been a really good thing, because I've had people like Stephen Gallagher has been in touch because of it. He wrote, you know, Warrior's Gate and Terminus, and various people, fascinating people. Andrew Scaletta and I are friends now. It's fabulous. I've got a lot of Andrew Scaletta paintings in the museum. So Neil Cole's Adventures in Science Fiction on Facebook, and on the website is museumofclassicsci-fi.com. And I'm on a YouTube channel as well, which, if you type in Museum of Classic Sci-Fi on YouTube, you should get some, it could be lovely. If people subscribe to that channel, that'd be great. Again, it's more just progress. I try to, I only put content on when I've got something to say, hopefully that's of, you know, interest. We had John Levine came and opened the museum, which was sublime. Sergeant Benton sat with my daughter and I, and we watched John Pertwee in my living room. I mean, that is just, you know, again, if nothing else happens, that happened. And that was just incredible. We've been watching the Three Doctors, right? My daughter and I. Sergeant Benton asked my daughter down. John says, bring her down. Introduces himself in uniform as Sergeant Benton to my daughter, saying he's just landed from the TARDIS. Shall we watch Doctor Who together? I mean, wow. That's just, you know, I don't care what happens now.
That's the kind of thing. That's the kind of thing that childhoods are made of, Neil.
Yeah, absolutely. It's marvellous.
And I've no doubt that through your museum as well, you know, the fact that people can come and see what you've managed to build and achieve, that you'll make a few extra childhoods with that. And I suppose through keeping an eye on you through social media, and hopefully your museum, you plan on more growth for it over the next couple of years, then it's a way of interacting with your audience and with your people who can make return visits year after year, really, and as the thing grows.
Yeah. I'm always going to be putting new things in. I mean, half of it's like a science fiction history. So you've got H.G. Wells, a bit of Star Trek, Dune, various other bits about, and some Marvel pieces in. And then I guess my true passion is the classic Doctor Who, and I'm always adding bits. I mean, I've got Mestor to go in yet. He's not out yet. Chimeron is going in as well. I've got various other bits and bobs to go in. Also, if you didn't know, if you want to see a bit of the product, the making of the museum on Netflix, Amazing Interiors episode 3, we filmed for 6 months with Netflix, which was mad. And that's on there, that's on Netflix as well. So that's quite nice. If you just want a sort of flavor of the sort of work I've been doing, which is quite good as well.
So the watchwords for the people out there who are interested in what you're doing, it's very much still watch this space. And this is just the beginning.
Yeah, well, it's just the beginning. I'd love to do more days as well. You know, we have guest speakers down, because what we've got is we've got a proper little museum here now. And these are unique pieces, you know. These are quite a considerable collection. You've got things like the Garm, Mestor, you know, you've got the surviving Cyber Scout from the sewers. That was, these only two made. I've got the one that was, didn't get blown up. You know, you've got Sill's original head. You've got the Galset, a surviving Galset gun from Sontaran experiment. There's a lot of unique, they're all unique pieces. So even if, you know, it's one of those places you're going to see something you're not going to see anywhere else. And basically I'm here to sit and enthuse with anybody who walks through the door. And if you turn up at 4 o'clock, we'll go for a pint afterwards next door, because there's a pub next door.
I don't know about you, Kyle, but I'm sold. I'll be there. I'll be there next year. So I'll see you then.
4 o'clock.
Yeah. Thanks for coming on to speak to us, Neil.
Oh, you're welcome.
It's been a blast, and it's just made me want to come more. So I'll definitely be there in 2019. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you,
Kyle.
Thank you. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Cheers. Okay, cheers, and guys. That wraps the interview. Neil, thank you so much.
You're very welcome.
This will probably go out sometime later this week, so we'll make sure to tag you in the museum in it so you can share it out too. We're going to share it out to all of our groups on all of our shows. We'll make sure there's links to the YouTube channel and to the Facebook page as well in the notes.
That was brilliant, Neil. Thank you. I know we put you on the spot, and I do appreciate you making time during your day.
I really appreciate your time, and I'm sorry I was a bit flustered at the start because I was suddenly the weather. Honestly, the weather went mental. Honestly, it was just semi-normal, and it was literally like a horror film outside, and it's bizarre. You know, I just had to shut everything up and do a runner.
Well, you know. I'll interact a little bit more with you on Facebook. If you want to come back on next year and talk to us some more, we'd love to have a longer form talk about some, because it's very much sort of it's very much an ongoing thing, obviously, and I feel like we're barely sort of scraping the surface. So we'll let you get back to it, and we'll catch up with you. Later.
Just let me know if you want any pictures or anything. Just let me know, and I can post pictures or anything. You know, if you want any. All right.
Smash. Yeah, absolutely. So much, thank Neil. It's been lovely to meet you, mate. Thank you.
Lovely to meet you guys too.
Yep. Cheers.
Stay in touch.
Likewise. Bye.
Bye. You gotta click it off.
That was a great interview, Dan. And I gotta say, if you don't head over there to check that out, I'm gonna take my TARDIS and go check it out. I don't know about you.
It was so much fun, and Neil's enthusiasm, as you could hear then, it really comes across. I'd have been straight up the motorway now if I could have been.
There you go. It sounds like he had a little weather, though. I don't know if I'd be wanting to go down there right now.
He's going through it a little bit, Get the sidemen to help him sort of snoop the skull up, maybe. They're pretty good with that.
Yeah, but let's talk some final thoughts, because, Dan, you brought it up to me. You think there was a couple... Kerblam conspiracy this week on Doctor Who?
Oh, God, yeah. Well, I was going to ask you about this because I couldn't remember. It's Amazon Prime, who streamed Doctor Who all over the world. They accidentally leaked Episode 8 a few days before it was broadcast on BBC One. And, they put it out as Kerblam. And, you know, there was a bit of speculation there that it was way too close to the broadcast of an episode, which did sort of gently lampoon them, didn't it? Kerblam definitely took a few shots at Amazon, so did Amazon do this right back at Doctor Who, just as a sort of have some of this, we can play that game too. What do you think, Kyle? Is that a conspiracy too far?
I think it's a little stretch. I think maybe somebody popped some bubble wrap and things got a little kablooey and kablammy. I think it's funny that that's how it happened. I just think it's kind of one of those things, because there are they do sign contracts and there's broadcast things. I think this was definitely an honest mistake, but it is a fun thing to think about what could have happened with that.
And you know what Doctor Who fans are like? Just like human beings in general, we're always looking for patterns and things, that aren't there?
Absolutely. There's always more to looking for. Call Mulder, call Scully, we'll get them investigating on this. But with that, we are going to close out this episode of Type 40. We hope you've enjoyed everything we've talked about. The witching hour is upon us. My thanks to both my co-host Dan and to Neil for joining us and telling us all about his exceptional museum. And I have a feeling they'll be back on to talk some classic Doctor Who before it's all said and done, Dan.
Yeah, that would be great. I'd like that too.
So again, thank you for joining us in our ride for this week's episode of Type 40. And you know what? There's only one way to end this, and that is Geronimo!